we have heard about the promise and the challenges of this emerging green jobs sector, the particular challenges faced by the growing numbers of formerly incarcerated men and women. If my reading of the data is correct, women is the highest growing component of the incarcerated population. And we've also heard about some of the challenges and opportunities around organizing low-wage, sometimes marginal and marginalized workers. So we have about 30 minutes to engage in some conversation around some of these challenges. Who'd like to start?
Do I need to wait for the microphone?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have
the
microphone.
Okay, that's fine.
So
I can speak loudly.
And identify yourself.
Okay, please identify yourself and address the question to any or all or all panelists.
Sure. Maricela Donahue with the Coalition on Human Needs. And both panels have raised both federal, national, and local strategies that can be implemented to achieve some policy goals that will bring concrete benefits and improvements to people's lives. I'm wondering, given the high unemployment rate, the economic crisis that we're in, what do you see as the best opportunities in the next 6 months, in the next year, to really, and the best openings to really push forward on some of these policies?
Would like to respond.
Well, I'll take of the ones that I mentioned, the best one is to get the preferential treatment for government contracts, because the government contracts for cleaning buildings, for building new roads, for paving whatever, for shoveling snow, all of those are going to be given out, even in a difficult economic situation. And so the preferential there, it also will allow organizations like OAR to go ahead and form companies, hire our own clients, and get those contracts.
Well, I would say that, and part of the problem is, in a way now, with the job quantity issue is probably overwhelmed the job quality issue, at least in the short term. I mean, particularly in the green jobs sector, a lot of the kind of excitement and optimism about that sector that we saw even as of last year and when our report was published earlier this year, has largely evaporated. And a lot of the projects that we write about in this report, a lot of the manufacturing operations have either, suspended, their operations or cut back. And in a way, a lot of the efforts to improve the quality of these jobs has become moot because the jobs don't exist anymore. So that's, that in a way, I think is the most pressing issue. Helping to restore a lot of these lost jobs. And then I think we might be in a position to deal with some of the quality issues.
I think that it's clear from the data that we face both a quantity problem and a quality problem. I think on the quantity side, some of the green jobs proposals are meant to try to begin to address kind of environmental issue on the job quantity quality. Issue, and I think our presenter did a pretty good job at highlighting some of the potential challenges of that, at least on the quality side, if not so much on the quantity side. It all depends on the size of both government and private investments that are made. I think the other two presentations were more focusing on, as policies are put forth that increase the quantity and quality of jobs, which sectors we need to make sure are not left behind or further behind, which I think partly what the point of the presentation on the formerly incarcerated is. Wasn't so much suggesting what we could do to improve quantity or quality. I think it was more dealing with, as we do, let us not forget that there are important demographies that shouldn't be left behind because it's ineffective, inefficient, inhumane, and actually quite costly. And I think from Gustavo's perspective, it was an example of how jobs that existed and have continued to exist were bad before and made better after. And I don't know if you saw a loss in quantity of jobs in that example, So if you didn't, then you have an example of a fixed quantity and increased quality, which is a win. But I think your observation is right, that there is a need to think about very short-term, very concrete and very clear job quantity proposals. And I think what Algernon mentioned about EPIs and the presentations next week are designed to make a major push on the what can we do on the quantity side, but all by people that also care about the quality. Because I think the danger that we face moving forward is that a discussion of job quality is going to be overwhelmed by a discussion of job quantity, and we're going to end up with any job is better than no job. And I don't know that that necessarily will improve outcomes for most. I think there's a lot of discussion when you compare the U.S. and Europe and other quote-unquote advanced countries, that Americans overwork themselves, work longer than any other country, and therefore get sicker and are less satisfied with their work than everybody else. So perhaps this is an opportunity to begin to think about the length of the work week, the length of the workday, and other kinds of policies that would allow for more job sharing at a given salary, which if our economy is driven by consumption, would actually tend to me to have a potentially positive effect without massive losses in productivity. But again, that's just a digression and almost personal opinion rather than a policy of any of the institutions represented here, including my own. Sorry.
We have the mic now.
Oh, sorry. How about?
Hi, John Kowal again. I'd be curious if any of the panelists are familiar with, and it's something that I might simply call creative solutions to the job number business. That is, I work at a university, the small institute, and as our budget began to shrink, I was asking other members of the institute, would you be prepared to work less hours, receive less pay, and not fire anybody? Their answer was no. Okay. Others have done differently, and I'm just curious. I have a daughter who works for a big consulting firm until recently, all of whom are making over $100,000 a year, but they knew the jobs were shrinking. And she said it was absolutely abysmal for her that everybody was preparing to push everybody else under the bus so they could keep their job and find reasons why others got fired before them. So aside from the bad news, do any of you have thoughts about creative solutions that are working, have worked, that might work in relationship to dealing with that, the balancing the numbers versus the loss of jobs?
Just to understand your example before the panelists respond, was the option less pay, less hours versus and half of you will get fired if you don't take it? Or
yeah, no. What? It was very informal, but basically the orientation was less pay for the same number of hours, same number of days, same number of hours. So we don't have to fire one, two, or three people. It wasn't a huge, big issue, but three people did lose their jobs.
Anybody care to respond?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, job, if we're talking about some kind of job sharing, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense as long as you have certain protections in place. I mean, you know, the risk for a lot of people is that if you go from full-time to part-time work, you may lose benefits, you may lose all or some of your benefits. So it's not just a matter of a loss of a certain percentage of your income, but it may be a loss, a much bigger loss, you know, of job security in a broader sense. But I mean, I agree that, you know, if you can build in those protections, that I think a lot of workers, you know, would prefer to have a temporary reduction in their total annual income than to, you know, to face, you know, a layoff.
It's back to that question again, which I feel that the ideology in America of we're a rugged individualistic society serves the best interests of the 10%. And that's wonderful because you don't have anybody, therefore, organizing themselves and seeing collective interests. And so the whole yo-yo option, you're on your own issue, is so endemic to our culture that I would argue presently it's harmful to the majority of workers but helpful to the minority of workers. Not what workers, the majority of economic interest people.
Well, it's a strategy that's also behind the increasing productivity of the workforce. And if you look at the same Wall Street Journal article, they have a graph of what they call the employment cost index, which has increased by the lowest point it's increased since they ever kept track of the statistics. So pay is increasing by 1.9%. If my memory is correct, the productivity numbers were about 7-8%. So we're really like squeezing the towel. Yeah. And I think people feel that and are more willing to be squeezed because they know the probability of getting another job has gone down, and the probability of getting another job at the same pay has gone down even more. So we are getting more productivity out of the workers. The question is this the best, the only way to do that? Any other comments or questions, or maybe our panelists like to respond?
Well, I mean, in a way, if you had the kind of culture of solidarity needed for job sharing, ideally you'd have the conditions for unionization too. Yeah. And then you could have much broader protections all the way down the line. And, you know, you're right that it's, you know, this kind of ideology of individualism has...
Are you familiar with any creative solutions? You know, we all know the problems are, and, you know, we listed a whole series of problems. We're all sitting around saying, yeah, gee, that's too bad.
Well, I think there is a need to look deeper, especially now where there have been a lot of offers out there and different plans,
yeah,
to empirically look at what choices people have actually made and what have been the consequences of those choices. Under what conditions people have opted for less hours, less pay, with the probability of less layoffs, either on their own probability or the probability of the people that work with them. Under what conditions that really hasn't worked out, and it's been more a free-for-all, yeah, where, as you mentioned, people try to throw each other under the bus and protect their own job at the expense of their colleagues. I think we have an opportunity now to kind of empirically try to look at, yeah, what has in fact happened. Now, on the question of kind of working class solidarity more broadly, I think you can see data on both sides, right? You can see some data that would suggest that we've lost some of that solidarity, but examples like Gustavo's and many others that we're seeing around where workers in a day labor corner actually agreed to a wage floor, for example. None of those 100 people that are on this corner are going to take a job for less than that. Yeah. Are examples of effective collective action. So I wouldn't necessarily conclude that desire for collective action is completely gone, as I think some of the panelists have said. You know, it's not necessarily where we would like it to be. But I think that there's a lot of upside there because the American people are hurting and pinching, and I don't think that they understand the solution to be whatever you can do for me. I think that there may be a desire for broader, more collective mm-hmm. solutions, but let's hear from others. Catherine, you want to say something? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, a lot of the talk around job creation is about short-term solutions for more long-term structural problems, and I think that's where we get that's why we keep hitting a wall, right? So we want to create jobs in all communities, but who are the first people in line for a new job? You know, people with resources, people with education, people who have just been unemployed for maybe 6 months max, not the long-term unemployed, not people in distressed communities who have been in recession or depression for a long time. So I think one of the things we should focus on is getting government to sort of man up, you know, to their job paving the path, of setting the example, of raising the standards in the new jobs that they create. So if there's a direct job creation program, that's where the standards need to be.
Being the optimist I am, I would hope that if you took that survey today, I don't know when you did it, would it have been in the spring?
Which survey are you referring to?
That you did a little informal survey of your employees.
Yes.
I would hope, because, I mean, everybody was kind of panicked about this and hadn't thought through. But if those of you who do the writing could write articles about what does it cost you to go to work every day? What is it, and what would a three-quarter job look like for you? That just get that in the public psyche. I would hope that attitude might shift a little and might shift enough that we start a different path. I asked our senior staff making the $50,000, and I said, we can't give any kind of raise, but I could give 3% raise to the three people that are making under 40. And this is Arlington. And but that means you don't get anything. And they all said, oh, that's fine. So
we ended up with less people working more hours as opposed to more people working less hours. And I think there may be a general desire to have more people working less hours for the same pay as opposed to less people working more hours for less pay.
Yeah, if I could real quick, just to touch on that point, in the service sector, I would actually discourage that. I would encourage for there to be less people working a full schedule for a variety of reasons. Number one, it costs the same to get to work when you're talking about transportation and childcare, right? And to work 8 hours, right, instead of five, right? It costs the same amount. Secondly, generally when there's layoffs in a union situation, there's a seniority list, and layoffs are done by seniority. And we would always rather have maintained the standard and the quality of the jobs there and have the people who are not there then collect unemployment, right? Just on a practical basis, it just works. It works better that way. I have seen situations where they call that spread the pain, right? Where everybody works less, and that generally is to the benefit of the employer, because if you're working less than a certain threshold number of hours, then they don't have to pay for certain benefits anymore. Right, so generally the employer will say would rather have people in the service sector, would rather have people, more people working less hours, because they also feel more marginalized, they're more beholden to the employer in that situation.
It's an interesting dynamic. I mentioned I'm from Chicago, and Walmart was coming into the city of Chicago for the first time a couple of years ago. And people in the community voted on whether they wanted a Walmart in the community or not. Now, in two instances, Walmart was voted out because they gave minimal benefits at all. The pay was incredibly low. And in one major community, an African-American community, they noticed it was low pay is better than no pay. And so they now have a Walmart going in. And this gets to be sensitive kinds of issues, you know. Who do you think you are saying, I shouldn't go to work at a pay that I'm prepared to get $7 an hour?
Judy.
Yes, Judy Conti from NELP. There's a way to actually sort of make the compromise between short time and what the very good points that Gustavo makes. Under federal unemployment law, states are authorized to create programs of short time compensation, where if there is this spread the pain, if everybody takes like a 20% reduction in hours and therefore pay, then they can also then get a 20% share of weekly unemployment benefits that they would be eligible for. Very few states actually do this. Connecticut actually does it very well. Senator Jack Reed has introduced a bill that would incentivize states to do it. It would fully fund it for a few years for them to create these programs, but it would be premised on the employers are not able to reduce any degree of benefit, seniority, or job protection that you enjoy. So workers would receive a little bit less money because even though unemployment would make up some of the difference, that's only 30 to 50% of the difference. But it preserves jobs, it preserves the benefits, it preserves the seniority. And it's something I know that's getting a lot of discussion on the Hill and in the administration, so I think it's something we all need to be aware of that could well be coming down the pike, trying to get other states to do this. I just have a quick question, and all of us that have spoken today, and I'm sure most people, if not everybody in this room, agree that increased unionization is obviously a huge part of the pathway to reviving the middle class. And I absolutely agree that the Employee Free Choice Act needs to be an indispensable part of that fight. But as somebody who's been a proud member of the union movement for the entirety of my legal career, and who regularly counsels low and middle income workers that they need to be investigating unionism, some of them won't do it because of fear, but more of them won't do it because they don't really understand what a union job can do for them in terms of job security, in terms of protection against unfair termination, a grievance procedure, the benefits, the wages, the whole bit. So while we know that EFCA is an important part of it, I think part of it too is that unions need to think more strategically about the ways that they are communicating their benefits and their importance to workers on a really much larger scale than they're already doing. And Gustavo, with your experience as a former union organizer and now doing such great organizing at Casa de Maryland, I'd love to hear if you or if any of the other panelists have ideas about ways that unions can do a better job really getting out there and effectively selling themselves and proving their worth in the community?
It's a very long answer, so I'll try to make it very short. Is that my training as an organizer was very focused on not trying to sell, quote unquote, sell the union, and go up to workers and say, here are all the things you can get, right? Or go there with a contract from a different hotel or a different casino or something like that and say, look, these people get this, 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 and that, right? So if you sign this, you're going to get this too. It's not, that doesn't work because it's not something that people can trust. You know, you put yourself in the shoes of a working class immigrant person, you know, so many people come to the door, there's so many predators around, right? Like that want something from you. It's either, you know, like frankly, there's some churches that do this, there's like, you know, check cashing scams, there's all kinds of stuff, right? Here in Northern Virginia, I know of several. That people generally have this initial distrust, right? And if something, you know, and I feel that, so the focus of the organizer should be more on digging for issues, agitating and talking about the union in terms that actually you described of dignity, justice, and respect. Because the wages are really important, but it's really important to talk about what do these wages actually represent, right? Like these wages represent being able to pay for medication and heating in the winter, both, and not having to make any choices. These wages represent being able to better take care of a child. These wages, you know, so it's not to talk about the money, it's to talk about what the money would actually change, right, in somebody's life. And then, you know, secondly, I would say there is the reason people are so reluctant, right, to organize the union is because there's been, over the last 50 years, a very concerted campaign by business interests in this country to discourage that and to put the fear of God into people, you know, that if they organize, they will be fired. Right, so it's not a coincidence. It's not like by happenstance that people feel this way, and it's worked very well. And what you were talking about, right, in South American countries, like I'm from Brazil, so you know, in my country, like this stuff is happening now. Like we're always like 20 years behind here, you know, but these same business interests are down there with force, you know, and so we shouldn't like sit around scratching our heads wondering why this happened. Like I know exactly why it happened, and how we turn that back is just by organizing. I don't have any better answer than that.
At the NELP conference last week, I think there was a healthy conversation about how to build better relations between the emerging worker centers, which waddle and quack a lot like unions did at the turn of the century, and today's unions, and how to make the strategies that worker centers are implementing be more professionalized and look more like union organizing campaigns to some extent, and how to make sure the union movement is more reflective and more open to the needs and the working conditions of folks that are at the margins. So it isn't so much about the contract for our workers, but more about how do you expand access. And I think Phil brought some examples his presentation about the work of the partnership, the laborers union and in New Jersey and in Gain, and laborers union, for example, has agreed to charter two new locals to begin organizing on residential construction out of a historic partnership with the National Day Labor Organizing Network, where there's been a realization that the day laborers are not competing with the laborers; they're in fact complements. Not without challenges, but an interesting emerging partnership. In Los Angeles, there's a campaign around the car wash industry, which has components of the green piece too. It's called the Clean Car Wash Campaign. It's a community labor coalition. And the steel workers have agreed to set up a local to organize the car wash workers. Don't ask me what the actual connection between steel workers and car wash workers, because I don't think cars are made out of steel anymore either. but there is some connection, at least in terms of them opening their union up to over 20,000 car wash workers in Southern California. So there are emerging collaborations, and there's people actually looking at those collaborations, trying to draw some lessons. Again, I think that there are lessons for worker centers in terms of how to connect to unions, and there are lessons for unions in terms of how to connect to worker centers so that we can reverse the trend of declining unionization and hope that the unemployment and unionization numbers actually never meet because the unemployment number starts going down and the unionization number starts really going back up.
I mean, what this brings up is a question we really don't like to talk about very much, which is that to a certain extent, unions are to blame themselves for the problem, you know, particularly the exclusionary practices that, you know, particularly unions in the building trades, you know, were guilty of for many years. And a sea change, you know, within the building trades unions, and the fact that the laborers, as you mentioned, you know, and some of the other trades are opening themselves up more to, you know, to the, in a sense, the new diversity of the workforce, you know, is a welcome development. And I think there's, you know, some more effort that needs to be done on that part. But to be honest, that's probably another factor why certain workers have traditionally, you know, been suspicious of unions, because unions, you know, the complexion of unions has not reflected the full complexion of the labor force. And I hope that's really changing now for good.
Yeah, and I think that there are some serious attempts to really understand both the imperatives of unions and why they do what they do with the need to be more open. Because part of their success is in controlling the skill level in that labor market, mm-hmm. right? Which is by definition a closing, an exclusionary process. And it's about once you get that good contract, passing it down to the members of your, right?
Family.
Which I'm sure is what all new workers that get in say, wait a minute, we just don't want this for ourselves, we want to pass it down, right? So there are some tensions and challenges, but I think that there's a great intention to kind of think it through and work it out, and we at least we at least have more and more people engaging in the conversation. I was in a similar conversation at the NELP conference where the person that was presenting the union side began the comments by saying, take, for example, the pipe fitters. They make $100 an hour. Of course, they have a strong interest in protecting their guild. I mean, not necessarily come one, come all, but regulating that process. And I think the more we understand the why unions do what they do, the better or the more likely will be to be able to find strategies that work for both, for the new workers that need to come in, but also for the existing workers, because I don't think we're going to make any progress by antagonizing current union membership, though I think there certainly needs to be an educational process that way. So, please.
Hi, my name is Abby Carlton. I'm with the Rockefeller Foundation. And you were just talking about efforts to bring minorities to green jobs, and I was wondering if there what you think the prospects are, or if there have been any efforts to bring women into green jobs more, because I know a lot of the green jobs are in more male-dominated industries. And then also just sort of a broader question about green jobs. I've heard a lot of conversations ranging from green jobs being just the latest fad to having a more lasting presence in our economy, and I was just wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, that's a lot. I mean, part of the problem is that there is not a good definition of green jobs, and people kind of conveniently define green jobs, you know, depending on their purposes, right? Those people who want to say that green jobs are good jobs will define the green sector accordingly, and right, will focus on things like, you know, the unionized technicians, you know, at utility companies, and say, you know, these are the green jobs, and, you know, look at the wage levels in these jobs, and they kind of do a little sleight of hand and imply that all green jobs are going to, you know, have that level of compensation and security and so forth. So, you know, what we've tried to do in this report, and it actually made some people unhappy, was to say, well, wait a second, that's not the whole story about green jobs. I mean, you can have, you know, in the report we look, for example, at some of the recycling work that's being done. And the, you know, these centers that process the recycled goods that are collected from people's homes, and you know, in some cases that job, you know, that work is really miserable. You know, people are paid minimum wage or sub-minimum wage, but then you also have examples in San Francisco, you know, where the Teamsters Union, you know, got a contract to run a state-of-the-art recycling facility that, you know, is paying, you know, as high as $30 an hour, you know, to do that kind of work. So it's, you know, there's no uniform answer. And in terms of, you know, jobs with women, again, it's a question of how you define, you know, the green sector. I mean, people tend to focus a lot on, you know, construction jobs, the construction component, and where women are underrepresented. But, you know, there are a lot of other, you know, depending on how you define green jobs, there can be other sectors where women, you know, have a more significant presence. I think in the area of weatherization, which is kind of a new field that doesn't fit into the existing building trades categories, there are more opportunities for women because you don't have, in a way, the same kind of male structures that, you know, have existed, you know, for decades. And I think that there are some more promising signs there that women will get a, you know, a better share of those jobs. And the fact that they're covered by prevailing wage rules will, in many parts of the country, help as well to make sure those are decent jobs.
The Workforce Alliance, the Apollo Alliance, and the Center of Wisconsin Strategy put together a document between the three of them that tries, to some extent, to do what Phil's suggesting of really doing the hard thinking around what are green jobs and what's green about them and what's their prospect in terms of future growth and engagement. That's to your first question of differentiating. And it's, I mean, I've heard conversations from, well, bus drivers a green job, to more sophisticated discussions. And I think that that document is helpful in terms of thinking through that. And I also know that in terms of the Labor Department, particularly the kind of Women's Bureau part of the department, they've been continuing conversations around two issues that you mentioned. One is kind of the pay gap or the wage gap. How to make sure that jobs that are dominated by women are not also the lowest paid job. So that's one about kind of pay increase for jobs that are dominated by women and the recognition that those jobs should pay higher, the kind of home care worker and some examples. But there's also conversation around access for women to traditionally male occupations, especially those that are considered high pay. And in that, there's a mixed record. I mean, I've looked at, you know, for example, highway construction, there's better record there. I also looked at and evaluated a commercial trucking program for women that was not that particularly successful. And this is just two anecdotes. I wouldn't generalize across sectors. But there's work going on in terms of thinking about this, the training that needs to be put in place and how jobs need to change to be more accommodating to women and some of the challenges and opportunities in terms of increasing the participation of women in traditionally male-dominated sectors, again, especially those that have high per hourly pay and that don't appear to have in their face barriers to entry other than the jobs are dominated by men who don't want women to enter, but that there are no requirements of the jobs themselves, if you will, though there are less and less jobs that you could argue as a requirement of the job themselves would be limiting to women. But that, you know, so there's very few jobs, but so people are really looking at that. And I know there have been conversations about how to revive funding for training for women to enter into sectors where they're not represented, but trying to do that not in a come one, come all, but in a more nuanced way that looks at what the effectiveness has been in the past. So there's no investment in sectors where it's incredibly uphill. There's more investments in sectors where there's already a track record that in fact, you can see women enter. And I was driving through a work site in New York yesterday, and there was a picket by, I don't remember the actual name of the organization, but it was Women in Hard Hats that were picketing a particular non-union construction site, A, for being non-union, and B, for not adequately including women as members of that construction site. So there's even more activism of women in the construction industry to reclaim, if you will, a fair, adequate proportion of the jobs for women. So it's a vibrant conversation and one that impacts immigrants also, because they're heavily concentrated on this heavily gendered, heavily low-pay sector. So any opening that could be made more broadly into other sectors is one where they potentially could really benefit from. Please.
And so I don't think they've published, but you might, they've been really looking at specifically what are the opportunities for women in green and what are the nature of those opportunities. You might want to.
Yeah, well, they were mentioned by Phil in his presentation, WOW, and others I think have mentioned WOW. They're really a phenomenal organization.
Hi, my name is Serena Lin from the Migration Policy Institute. One of the proposals that Argonaut put out is the creation of immigrant job career ladder. And I'm curious to know the panel's idea about sectoral career ladder strategies, and also for Gustavo about specific examples or barriers you think that exist for immigrants to move up within a sector. For example, like instead of working 18 years at a low wage for a very long time, what are some the barriers? Is it language, HR practices? What are the barriers you have identified?
Before the panelists respond, I just want to say our time is almost up. So I want to thank you all for sticking around. Let's give our panelists a chance to respond to your question and to say any final parting thoughts you may have.
Sure, I'll go first. I think you mentioned one huge barrier, which is language. Another one, though, is the threat of subcontracting, right? And I see that as being the biggest challenge to, private sector, service sector organizing in the future, is that what we're seeing more and more is that companies have gotten increasingly sophisticated at subcontracting different parts of their operations to third party, to temp agencies. For example, we've seen hotels like Hyatt, the chain Hyatt, has subcontracted the entire housekeeping department of a hotel so that those workers are actually employed by somebody else entirely. So there could be a whole different crew working in a hotel from day one to day two. And those, when they do that, the wages go down, right, for the same amount of work. Generally, the workload goes up, the wages go down. So it's a lose-lose in all, in all aspects. So I see that as being a huge challenge also to, creating anything like a career ladder, because what you're doing there is you're further marginalizing a workforce. I also organized in Los Angeles in the warehouse industry, where they do, they have this down to a science, where different warehouses are owned by, the physical building is owned by company A. It is operated by a third-party logistics company that then hires a temp agency to staff the warehouse. The goods of the warehouse go to a certain department at Walmart, but Walmart will actually use different warehouse companies to staff different, to serve different parts of their stores, right? So this is all done, so you, at the end of the day, what are the jobs, right, in that situation? Like, at the end of the day, you're left not with a $16, $17 an hour UFCW job, right, but you're left with a $8 an hour temp agency job where workers have to call up 10 to 12 different temp agencies every morning to just see if there's work that day, so... Those are the two biggest barriers I can see.
I am so grateful to be at the table. It seems to me that the plight of ex-offenders has not been well thought of or even thought of, and so I'm grateful that you all are listening to this particular segment of our population.
Well, I think one of the paths that, we need to put more emphasis on, perhaps we didn't talk enough about it today, are things like apprenticeship programs, that begin to provide a way for workers, particularly people from, low-income communities, people with less educational attainment, to kind of get on track to, to receive the better jobs. And, I think ultimately, we probably need to talk about when we talk about unions, not just talk about unions as a representative of workers once they're on the job, but also unions as an institution for controlling or influencing the process by which workers get hired in the first place, right? I mean, we used to have these things called hiring halls in, in many industries, and it was a way for unions to, to provide to play a role in both assuring a labor supply for employers, ensuring that workers with the necessary skills were available, and establishing, labor standards for those people who are going to be hired. So I think, in a way we need to, kind of rediscover and re-explore institutions such as these, which also serve to bolster labor standards, and to replace the kinds of pernicious institutions such as the temp agencies, and the other kind of middlemen operators that actually tend to drive down labor standards, and replace it with, kind of progressive institutions.
I think that one thing that we perhaps learned today is that the decline in good jobs is not the inevitable result of natural forces that are totally beyond our control. I think that what we've learned from all the panelists is that the decline in good jobs is a result of policies that have been pursued and choices that have not been made that have led to the current labor market and economy. I think all of the panelists have helped us understand how and why the decline in good jobs has taken place, why it is not an inevitable result of natural forces, and I think they've begun to lay the foundation for the kinds of steps that we need to take to make sure that we reverse that decline, and so that the next time we don't have a double negative title about reversing a decline, but we can have just a simple title about continuing the continuous improvement. And apologize for my own redundancy here in improving job quality for American workers. So thanks all of you for participating and for sticking around this morning. And we look forward to seeing you next week and continuing EPI forums, because again, if there is one thing that we know is that the debate over jobs and the debate over good jobs is not going to go away over the next 12 to 16 months. In fact, it's going to increase and it's going to become much more heated. We're going to be tempted with a range of policies on the tax side, and the tax reduction side. We're going to learn a lot about policies on the investment side. And I think if we are going to get anywhere close to getting what we think we need, we're all going to have to continue to participate in these kinds of thinking policy sessions, and are going to have to mobilize our individual and organizational resources to ensure that the policies that we care about, because they benefit middle class workers, are in fact put in place, so that we have a growing middle class populated by those that are in the working class going up, which is, I think, a goal that we all share. So again, thanks for taking your time to be here. We look forward to seeing you at the upcoming EPI events and forums focusing on increasing job quality for American workers. Thanks again.